To understand these Greeks would in itself be a sufficient education, and indeed a great American educator is making the experiment of giving 2 years of the college course for 100 fortunate students to a study of Greek civilization and all its varied wealth. The Romans do not give us so much, for though they admirably laid the foundations of social order and political continuity for the nations of modern Europe, they lost themselves too much in laws and wars, in building roads and sewers and warding off encompassing barbarians, to snatch from their hard lives the quiet thought that flowers in literature, philosophy, and art. Yet even here there are gods, the greatest statesman that ever lived, perhaps, made companionable by Plutarch's artistry. The somber Lucretius expounding in masculine verse the inescapable nature of things. The delicate felicity of Virgil weaving his country's legendary past into a cloth of gold. And last of the Romans, Marcus Aurelius, meditating on the vanity of lust and power from the vantage point of an unequaled throne. It is a tremendous and tragic story, how this great colossus bestrode all the earth with its majesty, and then through corruption and slavery, slowly rotted away, until barbarian armies from without, and Oriental cults from within, brought it down to ruin. Here it is that the greatest historian of all, Edward Gibbon, begins his stately recital of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, and plays with his mighty organ prose, a marche funèbre of desolation. Let us read those purple pages leisurely. Life is not so important that we may not spare for this philosopher writing history the unhurried calm that we must have in order to drink in the wisdom of his comments and the music of his periods. Gibbon is so generous that he tells the story not of dying Rome alone, but of that infancy of northern Europe which we know as the Middle Ages. Here is the rise of the papacy to the realization of the greatest dream of Western statesmanship, the unification of Europe. Here is the conversion of Constantine and the coronation of Charlemagne. Here is the bloody tale of how Muhammad and his generals, leading armies hungry for booty and infuriated with theology, swept over Africa and Spain, built the civilization of Baghdad and Cordova, and sank back into the desert when the Turks, still more barbarous than themselves, poured down through the Caucasus upon the disordered West. How the Jews and the Persians prospered under Moslem sway, let Maimonides and Omar attest. We shall find in Williams the noble record of Moslem achievements in mathematics and medicine, in astronomy and philosophy, and Four will show us their unique and delicate architecture, in the Alhambra at Granada, and in India's Taj Mahal. But there were a few Christians too in those days. Robinson takes up the human adventure and describes their civilization so well that we cannot spare him from our list. Dante and Chaucer sum up the age. The Canterbury Pilgrims, though on a pious mission, frolic with stories as earthy as Rabelais, and Dante, though at war with his church, lifts its theology to such splendor and dignity that for a moment we forget the barbarism that created hell. Abelard doubted that theology, but very suddenly lost the manhood to stand his ground. Nothing could be more pitiful and human than his weak abandonment of Heloise and doubt. If you would know how perfect, even in our stylist days, English prose can be, read George Moore's quiet narrative of this immortal love. Henry Adams tells that story too in Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres, and expounds the encyclopedic orthodoxy of St. Thomas Aquinas as incidents in his personally conducted tour of the great French cathedrals. Here Gothic is made to talk English and reveal itself even to Americans. And here also we come upon that unappreciated glory, Taine's History of English Literature, a book as scholarly in preparation and as brilliant in exposition as can be found this side of Gibbon. It took a Frenchman to explain their literature to the English. Finally, we listen to the masculine melancholy music of the Middle Ages, and the Gregorian chant surrounds and deepens us with its flowing majesty. Cecil Gray is no perfect guide here, he is only brief, and those who love music as the highest philosophy will deviate from our list at this point and read the 4th, 5th, and 6th volumes of the Oxford History of Music. Life without music, as Nietzsche said, would be a mistake. Then the Middle Ages melt away, and suddenly we stand before that full flowering of medieval art and thought, the Italian Renaissance. Mr. Wells gives us a few inadequate pages of outline, and then we abandon ourselves for 7 spacious and astounding volumes to the lead of John Addington Symonds, who took the very breath of his ailing life and even the latitude of his morals from this greatest epoch of the Christian age. If your years are too short for so extended a tour, read Burckhardt's single volume, The Renaissance in Italy. If you have learned to make haste slowly, read Burckhardt and Symonds too. Here again is a very swarm of genius. At Florence, we enter the palace of the Medici, where Pico della Mirandola is burning candles before the bust of the rediscovered Plato, and a boy called Michelangelo is carving the figure of a toothless faun. At Rome, we walk the marble floors of the Vatican with Julius II and Leo X, and watch them turning the wealth and poetry of the church to the stimulation and nourishment of every art. Vasari opens to us the studios of Botticelli, Brunelleschi, Leonardo, Raphael, and Angelo. Four rhapsodizes on this unprecedented efflorescence of painting, statuary, and ornament. Machiavelli makes Caesar Borgia sit for the portrait of the ideal prince. Cellini abandons murder occasionally to cast his Perseus or make a perfect vase. Bruno and Vanini renew man's effort to understand the world with reason. Copernicus, Vesalius, and Gilbert lay the cornerstones of modern science, and Palestrina takes us aloft on the wings of song. A supreme era unfolds itself for us in every phase of its winnowed wealth. But Luther, coming down from the cold, stern north, does not like the licentious art of sunny Italy. And in a voice heard throughout the world, he calls for the return of the church to primitive asceticism and simplicity. The princes of Germany, using the religious revolt as an instrument of policy, separate their growing realms from the papacy, establish a multitude of independent states, and inaugurate that dynastic nationalism which is the thread of European history from the Reformation to the Revolution. National consciousness replaces religious conscience, patriotism replaces piety, and every European people has for a century its own renaissance. It is an age of political romance, Catherine de' Medici and Henry VIII, Charles V and Philip of the Armada, Elizabeth and Essex, Mary, Queen of Scots, and her inextricable lovers, and the terrible Ivan. It is an epoch of giants in literature. In France, Rabelais riots with all commandments and adjectives, and Montaigne discusses affairs public and privy in the greatest essays ever written. In Spain, Cervantes finds one arm sufficient for writing the most famous of all novels, and Lope de Vega composes 1,800 plays. In London, a butcher's son produces the greatest of modern dramas, and all England, as Spengler would say, is in form. It is the springtime of the modern soul. Scholars are wont to say that after that brilliant coming of age in Spain, England, and France, Europe suffered a setback and fell from the high level of the Renaissance. In a sense, it is true. The 17th century is an epoch of religious conflict. The period of that 30 years' war which ruined Germany, and that Puritan Revolution, which put an end for a century to the poetic and artistic exuberance of England. But even so, consider the roster of that century. It is the time of the Three Musketeers, Richelieu and Mazarin, strengthen the central government of France against the feudal barons, and bequeath a united and powerful state to Louis XIV as an organized medium of security and order for the fine flower of French culture under Voltaire. La Rochefoucauld gives finished form to the cynicism of theaters and courts. Molière fights with ridicule the hypocrisies and conceits of his people. And Pascal mingles in passionate rhetoric, mathematics, and piety. Bacon and Milton raise English prose to its highest reach, and Milton writes, in addition, some tolerable verse. It is an era of mighty systems in philosophy, Bacon, Hobbes, and Locke in England, Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz on the continent. In science, it is the age of Galileo in astronomy, of Sir William Harvey in physiology, of Robert Boyle in chemistry, of Isaac Newton in everything. In painting, it is a shower of stars. In Holland, Rembrandt and Frans Hals. In Flanders, Rubens and Van Dyck. In France, Poussin and Claude Lorraine. In Spain, El Greco and Velázquez. And in music, Bach is born. Johann Sebastian Bach is one of the Olympians nearest to Jove. And you must not rest until your body and soul have trembled with the rhythmic majesty of the Mass in B minor, and the Passion according to St. Matthew. With the old organist of Arnstadt and everywhere, who had time between masterpieces to have 20 children, music reaches one of its twin dominating peaks. Not till the mad Beethoven will it scale such a height again. The 18th century is full of noble melody. Handel dispenses oratorios, and Haydn develops the sonata and the symphony. Gluck makes a noble accompaniment for Iphigenia's sacrifice, and Mozart, out of his sadness and his happiness, weaves such a concourse of sweet sound as makes all later compositions seem chaotic and discordant. If you wish to know absolute music, music relying not on stories or pictures or ideas, but on its own meaningless beauty, turn off your radio for a moment and play the Andante from Mozart's Quartet in D major. But here we are at the 18th century, which Clive Bell, in his precious volumette on civilization, rates with the Age of Pericles and the Renaissance as one of the three supreme epochs in the history of culture. An age of barbaric wars, advancing science, and liberated philosophy. Of baronial exploitation, fine manners, and such handsome dress as makes our forked pantaloons and incarcerating shirts seem funereal and penal. Those who have not lived before 1789 said that brilliant piece of, quote, mud in a silk stocking, close quote, as Napoleon called Talleyrand, have never known the full happiness of life. Read in St. Beuve's portraits the lives of these gilded men. See their pictures in Watteau and Fragonard, in Reynolds, Gainsborough, and Romney, and then take with Taine and Carlyle a front seat at the fiery drama of their fall. Think of an age that could produce such historians as Gibbon and Voltaire, such philosophers as Hume and Kant, such an undertaking as the French Encyclopédie, such a biographer as Boswell, such a circle as Johnson, Goldsmith, Gibbon, Burke, Garrick, and Reynolds, such novelists as Fielding and Sterne, still unsurpassed in England, such an economist as Adam Smith, such a cynic as Jonathan Swift, such a woman as Mary Wollstonecraft. And so the revolution comes. Aristocracy is guillotined, art and manners droop, truth replaces beauty, and science remakes the world nearer to its head's desire. Let Robinson tell of that industrial revolution which has so quickly and profoundly transformed our lives, our governments, our morals, our religions, and our philosophies. It is one of the great pivots on which history revolves. As the 18th century had been the age of theoretical mechanics and physics, and the next was the era of their victory in action, so the 19th century was the age of theoretical biology, and the 20th will see it in triumphant operation. New conceptions of the nature of development and man dominated the scientific scene and precipitated a war of faiths that has unsettled and saddened the Western mind. It was a century poor in sculpture, despite the unfinished Rodin, and a century full of dubious experiments in painting, from Turner's Sunsets to Whistler's Rain. But in music, strange to say, for who could have expected it in an age of machines, it outsang every other epoch in history. Here is Beethoven, passing with the turn of the century from the Mozartian simplicity of his early works, through the power of the Eroica, the perfection of the Fifth Symphony, and the subtle delicacy of the Emperor Concerto and the Kreutzer Sonata, to the mad exuberance of the later sonatas and the Choral Symphony. Here is Schubert, infinite store of melody, leaving unsung masterpieces by the hundred in his attic. Here is the misty, melancholy Schumann, center of one of the finest love stories in truth or fiction. Here is Johannes Brahms, looking like a butcher and composing like an angel, weaving harmonies profounder than any of Schumann, and yet so loyal to his memory that, though loving with full devotion the mad musician's widow, the greatest woman pianist of her time, and protecting her for 40 years, he never dared to ask her hand in marriage. What a dynasty of suffering, from the dying Beethoven shaking his fist at fate, through Schubert drunk and Schumann insane, through Chopin hunted by tubercle bacilli and deserted by George Sand, to Richard Wagner, genius and charlatan, who bore indignities for half a century, and then made German kings and princes pay the piper at Bayreuth. Happier was Mendelssohn, who was too kind and simple to suffer much, and Liszt, who drank fame to the last drop, till all his life was intoxication with glory, and Rossini, who preferred cooking spaghetti to composing The Barber of Seville, and genial Verdi, living on his Fortunatus purse of melody, and putting a barrel organ into every opera house in Europe. But when we pass to Russia, it is melancholy that strums the strings again. The broken Mazursky sings of death, and the pathetic Tchaikovsky, breaking his heart over a Venus of the opera, ends his life with a cup of poison. We may be sure of this, since all respectable historians deny it. Apparently beauty is born in suffering, and wisdom is the child of grief. The philosophers of our parent century were almost as unhappy as the composers. They began with Schopenhauer, who wrote an encyclopedia of misery, and ended with Nietzsche, who loved life because it was a tragedy, but went insane with the thought that he might have to live again. What a pitiful sight, once more, is the invalid Buckle, who never had a healthy moment in his life, and died at 41 before he could complete even the introduction to his History of Civilization in England. The only sound man in all the list of 19th century genius was old Goethe, who differed from Shelley by growing up. Read Eckermann's Conversations with Goethe, and treat yourself to a week's company with a mature mind. Read Part 1 of Faust, but let no historian of literature, not even the great Brandes, lure you into Part 2. It is a senile hodgepodge of nonsense, worthy of Edward Lear. The only other mind comparable to Goethe's in that age was that of Napoleon, powerful instrument of imagination, energy, and will. Let Ludwig tell you his story, and then read the 90 sparkling pages with which Taine analyzes the Corsican's genius in The Modern Regime. Absorb every word of Taine's chapter on Byron, and then read Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, Cain, and two or three cantos of Don Juan. Do not miss the Odes of Keats. They are the finest poems in the language. Verlaine and de Musset fall out of our list because no translation can capture their wistful melody. And Heine is included, despite the failure of all who have tried to transpose from one tongue to another the wit and music of his verse. Tennyson enters with In Memoriam and The Idylls of the King. But if courage failed not, his place would be given to Sir Thomas Malory, whose Morte d'Arthur is a stately monument of English prose. Of Balzac, when this century of books is done, you must read a great deal, for he is almost as illuminating as life itself. Skip through Les Misérables, but miss not a word of Flaubert's two masterpieces, Mademoiselle Bovary and Salammbô, which the list here dishonestly groups as one with the connivance of a publisher who issues most of Flaubert in one volume. Then you may nibble at the delicacies offered you by Anatole France, who is the distilled essence of French culture and art. Only Penguin Isle is named, but if you are a gourmand for beauty and subtlety of speech, you will read 20 volumes of Anatole. Take Pickwick Papers and Vanity Fair, or take David Copperfield and Henry Esmond, leisurely, but forget our egotistic depreciation of the Victorian age. Let our time equal that in literature, and then we may throw stones. Pass from England to Scandinavia, and, ignoring Ibsen's other plays, read Peer Gynt, the greatest poem since Faust. Cross over to Russia, taste the perfection of Turgenev, wander without hurry through the mountain ranges of Tolstoy's War and Peace, they're only 1,700 pages, and at last surrender yourself to Dostoevsky, the greatest novelist of all. Here again, every volume is precious. If you wish to be torn up to the very roots with instruction and human revelation, you will read not only The Brothers Karamazov, but Crime and Punishment, The Idiot, and The Possessed. After that, you may come home to America. Does the list slight some of our native heroes? But remember our youth. We have but lately passed from pioneering to commercialism, and are just beginning to emerge from commercialism into art. Whitman is our only giant yet. Thoreau is a stage in every full life, voice of that return-to-nature fever which burns in the blood of every youth who protests against being too quickly civilized. Emerson is a trifle thin today, and there is almost as little meat in him as in Thoreau, but those who study style must stay with him for a week. Poe, too, is a bit overrated, a man of melodious and spookish lines, a weaver of terrible tales that appeal to our bourgeois love of mystery and our tenderfoot delight in imagined pain. We are glad to suffer by proxy. We call Poe a great artist when we only mean that his biography is interesting and his sufferings attractive to us. It is always easier to love the weak than the strong. The strong do not need our love, and instinctively we look for flaws in their irritating perfection. Every statue is a provocation. And so we come to our own century, Age of Electricity and Götterdämmerung, Age of the Great Madness and the Mad Peace. Age of intellectual and moral change more rapid and fundamental than any epoch in history ever knew. Let Henry Adams reveal to you the secret of our time. There is no place for it here. Possibly Bergson has the answer to Adams. The mechanistic philosophy, which is the basis of our pessimism, is not the necessary conclusion of biology. Perhaps, after all, men are not machines. Havelock Ellis, the greatest scholar of our day, seems to us something more than a machine, and as we read Jean-Christophe, the supreme novel of our century, we catch the feeling of the artist as against that of the scientist, the sense not of helplessness, but of creation. Spengler differs from us, and will have it that our civilization is dying. If so, it is only because of that passion for power and that addiction to war which he admires with all the envy of the intellectual who thinks that he was born for action. Let Robinson and Wells, or, if you have time, Professor Fay, bear for us the origins of the First World War, that we may see how base these envied glories are in their origin, and how filthy in their result. And let our children read them too, that they may learn how wars are made, and how men may in 3 years retrace nearly all the steps that mankind has slowly climbed, through 3,000 years, from savagery to civilization. These are sad books, but by the time we reach the end of our list, we shall be strong enough to face truth without anesthesia. We may still believe, despite all our knowledge, that the race that made Plato and Leonardo will someday grow wisdom enough to control population, to keep the seas open to food and fuel for all peoples, and all markets open for all traders and all capital, and so, by some international organization, graduate humanity out of war. Stranger things than that have been accomplished in the history of mankind. 40 times such a marvel could not equal the incredible development of man from slime or beast to Confucius and Christ. We have merely begun. This, then, is our odyssey of books. Here is another world containing the selected excellence of 100 generations, not quite so fair and vital as this actual world of nature and human enterprise, but abounding nevertheless in unsuspected wisdom and beauty unexplored. Life is better than literature, friendship is sweeter than philosophy, and children reach into our hearts with a profounder music than comes from any symphony. But even so, these living delights offer no derogation to the modest and secondary pleasures of our books. When life is bitter, or friendship slips away, or perhaps our children leave us for their own haunts and homes, we shall come and sit at the table with Shakespeare and Goethe, and laugh at the world with Rabelais, and see its autumn loveliness with John Keats. For these are friends who give us only their best, who never answer back, and always wait our call. When we have walked with them a while, and listened humbly to their speech, we shall be healed of our infirmities, and know the peace that comes of understanding. Chapter 5. The Ten Peaks of Human Progress. In the year 1794, a young French aristocrat by the magnificent name of Marquis Jean-Marie de Condorcet was hiding from the guillotine in a little attic room on the outskirts of Paris. There, far from any friend, lest the coming of a friend should reveal his hiding place, he wrote the most optimistic book ever penned by the hand of man, Esquisse d'un tableau des progrès de l'esprit humain, a sketch of a tableau of the progress of the human spirit. Eloquently, he described the recent liberation of science from the shackles of superstition, and gloried in the triumphs of Newton. Quote, given 100 years of liberated knowledge and universal free education, he said, and all social problems will, at the close of the next century, have been solved. There is no limit to progress, except the duration of the globe upon which we are placed. Close quote. Having completed his little manuscript, Condorcet handed it to his hostess. Then, in the dark of night, he fled to a distant village inn and flung his tired body upon a bed. When he awoke, he found himself surrounded by the police. Taking from his pocket a vial of poison which he had carried for this culminating chapter of his romance, Condorcet drank it to the last drop, and then fell into the arms of his captors, dead. I have never ceased to marvel that a man so placed, driven to the very last stand of hope, with all his personal sacrifices of aristocratic privilege and fortune gone for nothing, with that great revolution upon which the youth of all Europe had pinned its hopes for a better world issuing in indiscriminate suspicion and terror, should, instead of writing an epic of despondency and gloom, have written a paean to progress. Never before had man so believed in mankind, and perhaps never again since. Search through all ancient Greek and Latin literature, and you will find no affirmatory belief in human progress. Not until the Occident brought into the Orient the virus of, the fever of, progress, can you find in any Hindu or Chinese thinker any belief in the notion that man marches forward through the years. It is a relatively new idea for men to have and to hold. Progress, a definition. What shall we mean by progress? Subjective definitions will not do. We must not conceive progress in terms of one nation or one religion or one code of morals. An increase of kindness, for example, would alarm our young Nietzscheans. Nor may we define progress in terms of happiness, for idiots are happier than geniuses, and those whom we most respect seek not happiness but greatness. Is it possible to find an objective definition for our term, one that will hold for any individual, any group, even for any species? Let us provisionally define progress as, quote, increasing control of the environment by life, close quote. And let us mean by environment, quote, all the circumstances that condition the coordination and realization of desire, close quote. Progress is the domination of chaos by mind and purpose, of matter by form and will. It need not be continuous in order to be real. There may be plateaus in it, dark ages, and disheartening retrogressions. But if the last stage is the highest of all, we shall say that man makes progress. And in assessing epochs and nations, we must guard against loose thinking. We must not compare nations in their youth with nations in the mellowness of their cultural maturity. And we must not compare the worst or the best of one age with the selected best or worst of all the collected past. If we find that the type of genius prevalent in young countries like America and Australia tends to the executive, explorative, and scientific kind, rather than to the painter of pictures or poems, the carver of statues or words, we shall understand that each age and place calls for and needs certain brands of genius rather than others, and that the cultural sort can only come when its practical predecessors have cleared the forest and prepared the way. If we find that civilizations come and go and mortality is upon all the works of man, we shall confess the irrefutability of death and be consoled if, during the day of our lives and our nations, we move slowly upward and become a little better than we were. If we find that philosophers are of slighter stature now than in the days of broad-back Plato and the substantial Socrates, that our sculptors are lesser men than Donatello or Angelo, our painters inferior to Velázquez, our poets and composers unnameable with Shelley and Bach, we shall not despair. These stars did not all shine on the same night. Our problem is whether the total and average level of human ability has increased and stands at its peak today. When we take a total view and compare our modern existence, precarious and chaotic as it is, with the ignorance, superstition, brutality, cannibalism, and diseases of primitive peoples, we are a little comforted. The lowest strata of our race may still differ only slightly from such men, but above those strata, thousands and millions have reached to mental and moral heights inconceivable, presumably, to the early mind. Under the complex strain of city life, we sometimes take imaginative refuge in the quiet simplicity of savage days. But in our less romantic moments, we know that this is a flight reaction from our actual tasks, that the idolatry of barbarism, like so many of our young opinions, is merely an impatient expression of adolescent maladaptation, part of the suffering involved in the contemporary retardation of individual maturity. A study of such savage tribes, as survive, shows their high rate of infantile mortality, their short tenure of life, their inferior speed, their inferior stamina, their inferior will, and their superior plagues. The friendly and flowing savage is like nature, delightful, but for the insects and the dirt. The savage, however, might turn the argument around and inquire how we enjoy our politics and our wars, and whether we think ourselves happier than the tribes whose weird names resound in the textbooks of anthropology. The believer in progress will have to admit that we have made too many advances in the art of war, and that our politicians, with startling exceptions, could have adorned the Roman Forum in the days of Milo and Clodius. As to happiness, no man can say. It is an elusive angel, destroyed by detection and seldom amenable to measurement. Presumably, it depends first upon health, secondly upon love, and thirdly upon wealth. As to wealth, we make such progress that it lies on the conscience of our intellectuals. As to love, we try to atone for our lack of depth by unprecedented inventiveness and variety. Our thousand fads of diet and drugs predispose us to the belief that we must be ridden with disease as compared with simpler men in simpler days, but this is a delusion. We think that where there are so many doctors, there must be more sickness than before, but in truth we have not more ailments than in the past, but only more money. Our wealth allows us to treat and cherish and master illnesses from which primitive men died without even knowing their Greek name. The outline of history. Having made these admissions and modifications, let us try to see the problem of progress in a total view. When we look at history in the large, we see it as a graph of rising and falling states, nations and cultures disappearing as on some gigantic film. But in that irregular movement of countries and that chaos of men, certain great moments stand out as the peaks and essence of human history, certain advances which, once made, were never lost. Step by step, man has climbed from the savage to the scientist, and these are the stages of his growth. 1. Speech. Think of it not as a sudden achievement, nor as a gift from the gods, but as the slow development of articulate expression through centuries of effort from the mating calls of animals to the lyric flights of poetry. Without words or common nouns that might give to particular images the ability to represent a class, generalization would have stopped in its beginnings, and reason would have stayed where we find it in the brute. Without words, philosophy and poetry, history and prose would have been impossible, and thought could never have reached the subtlety of Einstein or Anatole France. Without words, man could not have become man, nor woman, woman. 2. Fire. Fire made man independent of climate, gave him a greater compass on the earth, tempered his tools to hardness and durability, and offered him as food a thousand things inedible before. Not least of all, it made him master of the night, and shed an animating brilliance over the hours of evening and dawn. Picture the dark before man conquered it. Even now the terrors of that primitive abyss survive in our traditions, and perhaps in our blood. Once every twilight was a tragedy, and man crept into his cave at sunset, trembling with fear. Now we do not creep into our caves until sunrise, and though it is folly to miss the sun, how good it is to be liberated from our ancient fears. This overspreading of the night with a billion man-made stars has brightened the human spirit and made for a vivacious jollity in modern life. We shall never be grateful enough for light. 3. The conquest of the animals. Our memories are too forgetful, and our imagination too unimaginative, to let us realize the boon we have in our security from the larger and subhuman beasts of prey. Animals are now our playthings and our helpless food, but there was a time when man was hunted as well as hunter, and when every step from cave or hut was an adventure, and the possession of the earth was still at stake. This war to make the planet human was surely the most vital in human history. By its side, all other wars were but family quarrels, achieving nothing. That struggle between strength of body and power of mind was waged through long and unrecorded years, and when at last it was won, the fruit of man's triumph, his safety on the earth, was transmitted across 1,000 generations, with 100 other gifts from the past, to be part of our heritage at birth. What are all our temporary retrogressions against the background of such a conflict and such a victory?